Every year, thousands of students go on their first holiday abroad. Our 5G roaming in 80 countries means they're connected as soon as they land.
Just a reminder to wear sunscreen, love, because you're as pale as a ghost. Oh, and can you send me all your friends' numbers because their mothers are on to me? And always keep your cash in your bum bag, yeah?
Every connection counts, which is why Ireland can count on our network. Vodafone. Together we can.
Subject to coverage availability. Limitations and terms apply. See vodafone.ie/terms.
Go Loud presents Murder Most Irish. Find it first on the Go Loud app and on all major podcast platforms.
I take you from behind, Sarah Jane, and make you feel wonderful.
It's us again. Can you believe it? Me and her.
Hi. We did a thing. It's not a normal episode. Shock horror.
We got to interview an author, an Irish author, 28 years old, who has done more in his life than I will ever do, by the name of Killian Dunn, who wrote a book called Dreams and Incarceration. And it is about a gentleman named David Spivey, who was incarcerated in the California jail system, if you will, for 15 years. David murdered someone when he was 17. He was part of a gang and was incarcerated for life. But Governor Jerry Brown commuted sentences and David was released early. The book basically covers from David's youth into his time in jail. And it doesn't cover his current life, but you can find out a lot about David. He's quite easy to find online. He's a motivational speaker. It's a great book. It's on Amazon. You can only buy it on Amazon, but I would suggest you do because it's heart-wrenching and lovely and sad and all the things you would expect in a book. So Sarah Jane and I sat down for an hour. It was 57 minutes, which was crazy because it did not feel like an hour.
No, it didn't. The conversation flowed, yeah, which is very good. You were very good, Emma. I'm not going to lie. Emma did all the prep.
I'm always worried that I am not gonna ask the right questions to people. I always worry about that.
You're just like, this is like, I don't know how many times I have to tell you. You fucking qualified journalist. Like, this is literally what you studied in college, you stupid bitch.
People are like, you know, they write books. What do I do?
You write very funny text messages to me.
And you write very funny text messages to me. a little book of our text messages and then get
we canceled. Saw the Mudang ones recently have been Mudang. I love Mudang. And now I'm obsessed with Pesto.
Pesto and Mudang are the shining lights in this dark, depressing world at the moment. What? And if anybody's going to Mudang's enclosure and throwing things at her, your mother is a hoe. People are going to Mudang's enclosure and like throwing things at her to get her attention. So now what they do is they've put it into like 10-minute segments where you're allowed to see her because it was too many people. She's a superstar. There were too many. She's the Beyonce of pygmy hippos and too many people were turning up.
Now I have to tell you something. She is a superstar and she deserves to be a superstar.
Fully deserves to be a superstar. I love Mudang so much. But stop going to her enclosure and throwing things at her. Leave her alone.
Leave her alone.
Pesto is the best because that video of Pesto where he's just like standing looking at it, like looking like this. He's not even trying to be like, I should step back from this.
I had a really tick moment with Rachel because Rachel is the one that got me onto Pesto. I forgot that penguins are birds. And I was like, how did that penguin give birth to that penguin? And she was like, it was an egg. And I was like, shut up, Rachel.
Oh, Sarah. that's hilarious. And oh, my God. How did that happen? The other penguin's vagina.
She was like,
an egg, was an egg. Bitch.
And then to try and pull it back, I was like, how big was the egg? And she was like,
a normal size egg.
Shut up.
He's huge, though. He's gorgeous.
Have you seen his mom and dad?
Yeah, they're like little people. They're tiny little penguins. And like, this thing just and also is loving the attention and doesn't give a fuck.
Well, he is me as a baby. I was a big old baby.
I want to get a Mudang tattoo so bad, and I know I shouldn't because it's just like, it's like a fast fashion moment, but like, I really want to get a Mudang tattoo.
I just like, I on a date, like, Rachel's like, your obsession with this hippo, she was like, new levels. When I tell you, I'm like, she like, you're not the people's princess, the people's princess,
honestly. And I'm not one that goes for like cultural things at the moment, usually pisses me off. That fucking hippo, man, she's all that matters. Yeah. All the people drawing art of her, like, people are making Mudang hardcore t-shirts. I'm obsessed and I need all of the merch. She looks wet all the time. I love her.
Like, I love her too.
Sebum skin. She's got great skin.
She's just, and she's a beautiful hippo.
Munching because she's learning how to munch from her mother. She's,
my favorite video is one where she's biting the legs of the keepers.
And they're spraying water and she's like, fuck off. Like, I love her.
Yeah, no, I love her.
A sensation. Anyway, the world's hell. Just enjoy Mudang. We were talking about a book. Hello to Killian's mum, Gabriella. She's going to be listening to this.
Oh, hi, Killian's mum.
Hi, Killian's mum. How sweet is that? She's like, it was so nice. Like, my mother reads all my books. I was like, my mother still asks me what I do and is it a podcast? So, hooray for Killian's mother, because she knows.
My mum goes, when I'm working and if I'm with her, I have to take a call or I have to do something. Do you have to do that? Do you have to do that?
Yes, I do.
Could you not just leave that phone alone? Like, could you put that down? Like, my mum is, Gabrielle. Is Gabrielle or Gabriella?
Gabrielle, I think.
I mean, a wonderful, beautiful job.
Mrs. Duff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or Ms. Duff, or whatever, however you, Gabriella, I'm not calling you any name that you're not. I've got to rein this back in. We love you. You did a great job with your son. He's a gentleman.
Yeah, he's very nice.
He's nice, and he's got great hair.
I didn't want to say anything, but he was, I tell you what, he's got that hair. Hasn't got the receding hairline of most Irish men.
Got so well done. Good solid GAA player hair.
Oh, fuck me. He is a good solid. I was an athlete in school.
He absolutely was. He went to college for soccer, as he called it, because now he's a Yank. Killian, I'll call you out on this podcast. But we had a lovely time talking to him. He's such a nice guy. And I hope everybody goes out and buys his wonderful book. And I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. It's a bit different, but he's our first guest.
Yeah. No, did you not do a guest with Scott?
Oh, we're putting Scott's episode after this one.
Oh, okay. Well, then there is another one to come with a guest.
Yeah. But Killian is our first guest. So thank you to Killian.
Killian is our first guest. And his book is very apt for what we talk about, which I think is good.
Yeah, I was just like, obviously Marcellus Williams was executed a few days ago in the United States.
Yeah.
Because obviously a lot of people were saying he didn't commit these crimes that he was accused of. And even the families of the people that died have said, please don't execute this man. And the Supreme Court went, no, we're going to do that.
The whole thing is just like, I don't understand why that man has been like murdered.
It's horrific. Actually, because earlier when I read the book, obviously, it's very much based on kind of the racial divisions in prisons are crazy. Like, you go with your own race. There's no integration of races. It's Asian people with Asian people, Black people with Black people, White people with White people. But the percentage of Black people in American prisons is ludicrous. Mm. Ludicrous. And I found an article today that said in the year 2000, African Americans made up half of the United States prison system, but only 13% of the US population. By 2000, they were imprisoned at five times the rate of white adults. And then 2023, imprisonment rates of Black people fell by nearly 50%. Since 2000, but black men and black women are still being imprisoned at higher rates than white people. So the book itself kind of shows that in lower income areas, in disadvantaged areas where people aren't given the sort of, opportunity that other people have, you're more likely to end up in this system. I believe they said one in five one in five black men could potentially end up in prison in their lifetime. And that's not an okay statistic. And there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why people in disadvantaged areas in Ireland end up in prison and jail. So it's just, it's an interesting thing to note that, and obviously people, black people who commit crimes that white people commit in America are punished more. And that is a fact as well. And often die at the hands of the police. For no reason whatsoever. And then if they don't die, they're put in Rikers Island for 5 years while they await a fucking trial. So it's a mess.
The prison system in America is an absolute mess.
Fucked. And I'll tell you what it is. It's fucking chattel slavery. That's what it is. They need to keep those prisons full so they don't have to pay people to do stuff for them and to create America and to clean up their cities. That is literally what they're doing. So, please read Killian's book. It's called Dreams and Incarceration. And he has another book before that called Death by a Million Paper Cuts. And he told us he's currently working on two more books, one of which would definitely be an interest of the lovely people that listen to our podcast. So
here is just, you know, you're absolutely fucking about for 40 years of your life. Just sitting in front of you, Sarah.
I personally think one woman who's 40 and one woman who's nearly 39 talking about a pygmy hippo is perfectly fine. We are doing great. Basing our mental health on a sebum-laden pygmy hippo in Thailand is okay.
Let me tell you something. I got moved. I moved my desk and work. Right?
These are the real problems. What happened? Right. What happened with your desk moving? Tell me.
When I tell you, like, nobody needs to diagnose me with anything. I know I have something. I'm working through it.
Undiagnosed, but pretty sure.
I cannot focus.
Really?
At all. Oh my God, they've moved me and they've put me, like, I've been moved into a place. No, they haven't moved me. I've moved myself. And I.
Of your own making then?
Yeah, no, this is some of my own making. And I have segregated myself from everybody. I'm in a little, like, cocoon. When I tell you, I need the potential risk of getting caught to continually make me do work.
Is that gone now?
Gone. Gone.
Fuck. Okay, I kind of understand that.
I've been trying to write a fucking document. And for 3 days, I've watched Mudang videos on my phone.
Listen, right now, we need to watch Mudang videos. The document can wait. What's the document going to do?
I think
nothing.
I need to move back seats. I think I need to be honest.
No, don't.
I'm hoping I'll get used to it.
You'll get used to it. And then you'll be like, right, I'm back into my the old swing of it.
It's like an Amazon when I had an office and I never sat in it because I got no work done in it.
Oh, I would have been the exact same if I had an office. I literally would have just not done anything.
No?
That Netflix would have been on in this screen.
It was podcasts. I never watched like anything in my office, but podcasts would be on.
So also just the Vince McMahon documentary, Mr. McMahon, is up on Netflix.
Ah!
That shit's crazy. All I've been doing, texting Colin going, did this really happen? And he's like, yeah.
I'm going to watch it with Graham.
Please do. It's crazy. Wrestling is crazy. Crazy. The amount of shit that happens that I'm like, what is this? No. And he's like, no, that's
it. What were the subject titles of his emails he sent to the lady?
Ari, your pictures. So now me and Colin will just text each other every now and again. Go, if he sends me a picture, I'll be like, Ari, your picture. Bear in mind, the pictures this woman was sending were of her vagina. So this 80-year-old man was replying, Ari, your pictures.
Ari, your pictures. I had a conversation today with someone in work from a guy that I work with. He's from India and he didn't know who Sinead O'Connor was until very recently. And his dad was like, do you know about that? She was very famous and it's very sad. And I said she was very famous. I was like, she also had like a level of integrity that does not exist often in the music industry or in like any form that industry. I was like, actually, in general. And he was like, really? And I was like, she was at the height of her career. And I was like, and she went on to Saturday Night Live and ripped up a picture of the Pope. I was like, and like tanked her career in America, like actively was like, what's happening is wrong. And he was like, really? And then I heard myself do it and realized that there was no reference to what I was doing.
Did you say I love you, Juliet. Did you?
Just her Indian man was looking at me going, oh, child abuse, yay.
Sarah, he's going to go to HR and be like,
I explained it afterwards because I could see him looking at you, and I was like, I say this to my friend Emma at least once a week, and he was like,
yeah, there are certain things that we just can't, you kind of don't, in the moment, you're like, I can't say that to you because you will not know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And then he was like, oh, okay. And then I remembered as he was walking away that he was a devout Christian.
Well, I mean, such is life.
Just can this week's episode just be this picture? Everything's going to be okay.
Everything's fine. we've gotten a way off on a tangent here, but yeah, everybody enjoy this week's episode. I'm going to link Killian's Instagram and David's Instagram in our notes. So send them some love if you can. Pick up Killian's book. It's on Amazon. It's called Dreams and Incarceration. And once again, thanks so much to Killian for deciding to be on our podcast because, you know, I don't know why, but thank you.
You know, thank you so much. And honestly, like, everybody go and read his book. It's really fucking good.
Hey, Colin, tell us about the Patreon.
Sure thing, Lily Pops. Hey there, MMI fans, it's me.
Every year, thousands of people go to their very first concert. Our boosted signal at large events means they can always call a taxi to get home.
Mom? Yeah. It was grand. Do you think you could pick me up?
Every connection counts, which is why Ireland can count on our network. Vodafone. Together we can.
Subject to coverage availability. Limitations and terms apply. See vodafone.ie/terms.
Colin, and do I have news for you? It's all going down over at www.patreon.com/murdermostirish, where we've totally revamped our Patreon offering for you mega fans. That's right. Now all of your favorite Patreon stuff can be found in one place as we bring you our MMI Super Show exclusively for Patreon, featuring all the usual banter and chat between Emma and Sarah Jane, plus me thrown into the bargain, along with Lily's Tales, Maximilian's Bell Bag, and some surprises along the way. But that's not all. Every single week, due to popular demand, we will be bringing you a full-length story, whether it be Miscellaneous Most Irish for those cases that just don't fit on the main show, Murder Most International for those cases you guys have been crying out for, or even Music Most Awesome, where we talk about our favorite albums. But wait, there's even more! How about MMI Drive, the fan favorite podcast show where Emma and Sarah Jane drive around Dublin talking about all sorts of shite, plus our monthly Ask Me Arse segment where you get to pick the brains of the girls and maybe even ask me a question or two. So what are you waiting for? Come on over to www.patreon.com/murdermostirish and join in the fun for only €6 a month.
Give my mammy €6.
We are speaking to the lovely Killian Dunn. And he has written a book called Dreams and Incarceration, which I read, which is fabulous. And actually sent it to my sister yesterday, so she's now reading it as well. And it's about a gentleman named David Spivey. Am I saying his surname correctly?
You are, yep.
Because I want to say Spivey, but that's so it's Spivey.
I was saying Spivey for the first like month interviewing him, and then one day he corrected me. It's Spivey. Yeah, I know, it's embarrassing, but yeah.
And David was incarcerated for 15 years. I don't obviously want to talk too much about like what he did or anything like that. That's not my place to talk about that. But basically your book is a story of what happened to David while he was in prison. So I will choose my first question. My first question was how long you had been living in the States and why you moved there. Cause I just kind of wanted to get an idea if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. So I've been in America like 10 years ish now. I was actually born in the States. That's why I've been able to stay here for such a long time. I hold two passports, and I moved to the US for college. I got scouted to play soccer at a college in Boston. And then that was a 5-year college. So I did 5 years there. And then I've been in LA, well, like five and a half years there. Been in LA like four and a half years. So
amazing. Do you like
it? I love LA. Yeah, it's great. Oh, okay. It's obviously very, very different, but it's a lot of fun. I have a really good time here.
Good time. And when you were in college, did you study anything to do with literature or English or anything like that? That was just...
No, all self-taught. I started out writing screenplays, actually, with my buddy leaving cert year. So in sixth year, instead of studying for the leaving cert, I was writing screenplays with my buddy. And then I just kept that going. And then I just decided to sort of do that and write books when I was 22. So I wrote my first book when I was 22. But I didn't study literature or anything like that. I studied marketing. Like, I just did all that stuff in my free time. Yeah. And ended up just doing it so much over like 4 years that I just kind of got good at it. And I really, really liked it. And I just kept doing it.
Yeah, because if you don't mind asking, what age are you?
28.
Oh, you're just a baby. Yeah. But like, to be 28 and to be tackling subjects like this is amazing and very intense. But
yeah, how you guys, the two of you clearly bonded. Like, how did you? You got to meet him at like a he was working at some party you were at. Yeah.
So my buddy and I throw networking events out here in LA because we were also like trying to sort of break into the film industry, and basically one thing led to another, and we had this event on New Year's and we needed to hire security. So we had gotten a referral to this like security company that Dave just so happened to work for, and nobody came to our event. It was like the biggest dud of all time. Aww. So I ended up just talking to David for like 3 hours instead of like working. And I didn't know anything. I didn't know he was gang affiliated. I knew formerly gang affiliated. I didn't know anything. I just thought he was a funny guy that I had like a good time with, and then followed him on Instagram. And he put up like maybe 2 weeks after I followed him, he put up an hour long video on Instagram, basically just like saying, for all my new followers, for everybody that just met me, you know, this is my past. And like, I'm, you know, I murdered somebody when I was a teenager, went to prison, got like life in prison, but got out after 15 years. And he is just like an extremely eloquent speaker. Like, he's a great storyteller. And so I saw that, and I'd written 3 books before that, and I was looking for my next one, and I was like, Jesus, I have to write about this guy. Like, it's just, everything was within reach, like very accessible. So I just hit him up. I texted him, asked if he'd be cool with like talking about me writing a book about him. And then we met up in person. And then I just sort of said, fuck it. And I quit working altogether. I wasn't making any money for like 6 months while I did the research and wrote the book about him. Shit. Yeah, I straight up, like, I technically went homeless for like 2 weeks until an Irish family friend here took me in.
And what was the timeline between meeting him and asking him to let you write the book?
I met him on New Year's Eve, like 2022. So let's say January 1st, 2023 was like the day I met him. And then he let me, or like we sort of locked it in by March. And then by May 1st, I was like, I'd quit everything else. And I was sitting down with him, interviewing him. And then I did a bunch of other research on the side. Like, I spoke with like prison wardens and like prison psychologists and just like a whole variety of like people, like formerly incarcerated gang members, people that were in prison. Like, I was getting calls from prisons here on the West Coast.
You were like locked in on this. You wanted, this was like,
oh yeah, it was like the only thing I was doing. I wanted to just sort of prove to people that I could do something that was really like outside my wheelhouse and do a really good job of it. Cause I really like this kind of style of storytelling. It's kind of like narrative nonfiction. So I just like hop inside the brain of somebody that has lived this crazy experience. And then I write about their experience from their perspective. And it's kind of a unique thing. Not too many people do it, which is why I sort of like leaned into it.
because I was going to ask you, one of my first questions was, when you initially told me about the book, I was expecting it to be written in the third person, but it's written in the first person. And was that like, when you were thinking about writing it, were you like, I want this to read as if it's a, he's writing a diary? Was that the point of it?
Kind of, yeah. The other, like the book I'd done right before Death by a Million Papercuts, that was written in the same style. So I just, I don't know why I really did that, but I'm really interested in like the psychology of things. So I, you know, I'm not crazy about like plot is really important and all that sort of stuff, but I'm really interested in knowing like what makes some, like why, or like what makes someone tick, like why people do what they do and how sort of like the various milestones of events can lead to something like really big like that. So with David, I was like, there's so much stuff that I don't understand. And, but like everything with David was all about like the way he felt about things, if you kind of know what I mean. So it wasn't necessarily like, you know, this guy crossed me, so I shot him. It was more so like, I was feeling the pressure from like my peers that I had to do something. Now, yeah. I think those are two different things. So basically I wanted to write it in the first person to get like as much emotion as possible, because right. It's like a hard, you know, if you look at it on the surface level, like I'm trying to make people sympathize with a murderer, with a gang murderer, you know what I mean? Like that person arguably doesn't deserve your sympathy. But I know David and I know the way he feels and the way he thinks. So I think that by just being 100% honest and relaying that across the page, coming from his voice, is the most effective way for the reader to give a shit, basically.
Absolutely. And it really, really worked. It truly worked. And I was actually, when I was reading it, the thing that I kept doing, which is just testament to how well the book is written, is in my head, I kept thinking it was fiction. And I kept rooting for certain people and being like, oh, I hope this happens. And I'm like, that's not going to happen because this is real. So, it's a real story. I was like, I want this guy to be gone. And I'm like, but that guy's not going to be gone because this is full life. But I haven't read a book, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, I haven't read a book in a long time that genuinely had that effect where I was getting pissed off because it wasn't going the way I wanted it to go. So I just thought that was really fascinating to read something like that, because it is true crime, but in a way it feels fictional. It's not at all. Like everything you said is true. But you did a fantastic job on that. So I just wanted to compliment you on that, because it was the one thing really enjoyed. And I actually wanted to ask, just touching back on you saying you wanted people to feel sympathy for somebody who had murdered somebody. Did you find it difficult initially to, when you started interviewing David, to not feel a sense of slight judgment or dislike for him as a person for what he had done? Or was that easy for you to compartmentalize and be like, no, he's actually this person now, and that's the past, and that's what I want to write about?
Yeah, I kind of have a knack for this sort of thing. There's a reason why I feel comfortable in this space, and I think it's because I can emotionally dissociate from those kind of facts and just focus on the things that I think need to be focused on. Now, that being said, you know, there was never a moment in our conversations where I was like, you know what, David, like what you did was okay. You know what I mean? It's like, it was very, very upfront. I was like, no, you did like a fucking terror. You did the worst thing. One of the worst things that somebody can do, but you have paid for it. Like he's paid for it. Like I know it's in the book, but they're like, he's the challenges he's gone through because of like his actions. Like in a way it's commendable. And I'll put it this way. Like if the victim's mothers can forgive David and basically sign off on his release, I think I can too, and I think most people can. It's also I know it's really controversial. It's a really tricky thing, and David's also like, listen, if you don't like me or if you like hold prejudice against me for what I did, like I get it. He's like, I'm just focused on being like the best person I can be now. And then also, you know, I went to his neighborhood, like I did my research, and like, it's, you know, it's, and pardon my French, but like, it's fucking crazy over in that part. Like I know we were joking around about Finglas at the start of the call, but like, Finglas looks like, Yeah, Finglas looks like Beverly Hills compared to like where he's from. So yeah. it is crazy. And, you know, that gang stuff starts at like a really young age. Like we're talking like 9, 10, 11. Like it's really young. So there is a bit of indoctrination involved. And I think there, in my opinion, there is no sort of like morally correct answer in this situation. But the facts are the facts. He did these terrible things and he's just time in the California state prison system, and he got a sentence commuted by the governor of California. So he did what he had to do to get out.
Yeah, no, he did. And it also, of course, as you were just saying, these kids are as young as nine or 10 when they're being brought into these gangs. So mm-hmm. from an outside perspective, it's very easy to make a judgment. But then when you're in it, it's like, this is all you know. This is your entire life. So yeah. And I mean, even it's quite apt with what happened to Marcellus Williams yesterday, the day before, who was executed. It's so terrifying to think that that could have potentially happened to David. Luckily, it didn't, thank God. But, you know, there is that side of it when I was reading the book where I was like, God, this easily could have gone down a very different route. So, you were actually saying earlier that you did speak to other people in the prisons. And I just wanted to ask, did you speak to any of the people that were mentioned in the book, any of the prison officers or the other inmates that were with David?
So none of the officers or anything like that. I did speak with, like, there's this title in prisons called a community resource manager, and they're very accessible. They basically, like, if somebody wants to come in and do like a volunteer sort of service at a prison, you speak to the community resource manager and they sort of hook it all up. So I spoke with a lot of people that worked at the prisons that David was incarcerated at, and I spoke with some of his friends who are in the book. There were a couple of names that I did change, or like I used like a nickname instead of a real name. And that, I mean, candidly, that was just because like I don't want any like former gangsters like knocking on my door being like, yo, like you use my name without my permission. Like give me $5,000. You know what I mean? Like I'm not going to get fucking extorted. So I just use my better judgment, and some of the names are real, some are just like nicknames that David was like, nah, use, like, call him this.
Yeah, because even I was saying to you earlier about me feeling like the book was fiction. The character of Puma.
Yeah, he's real.
Dude, I was hoping you were going to say amalgamation of people. He's real.
Yeah, he's one guy, and the reason why he stuck out to me so much is because David was like visibly, when we were doing the interviews, he was visibly like, this is the worst person I've ever met. Like, he's like, this is the worst guy. Like, wasn't even really affiliated with anyone. He was just like a massive black dude who was also coincidentally a rapist. Just like the most terrifying. Like, I wanted, because like I was told by this like really old author, like while I was writing the book, that where if you're writing a book about a guy who is bad, like a not even like an anti-hero, just like someone who's bad, he's like, the way to do it effectively is to make everybody around him in some way worse, or like they have to like bring out, or they have to be able to bring out the good qualities like in David. So I was like, I wanted Puma to just be like the worst guy that you can imagine, that like you even see his name on the page and you're like, oh shit, like something's about to go down.
His name was written, I was like, not this fucker. Like, I couldn't. Yeah. I was like, that's what I mean. He was one of the main catalysts for me being like, I need this guy gone. And every time I turned to a different chapter, I was like, here he is again. And like, even how I described him, the lip licking.
Yeah, it's awful.
Oh, I couldn't deal. I hated him. But just I could see him in my head, and it was so upset. And there was other characters I could see, but him specifically, I could see him in my head. And as you said, you kind of wanted to create a character that made everybody worse around him. People were losing their lives, giving away their chance of being freed because of this guy. Like, they were actively like, I want him gone. I wanted him gone. But they were like ruining any potential future they had because of this one person. Yeah. And I was hoping he wasn't real, but he's real. I thought maybe you'd admit you took like 10 people and were like, I'm going to take all the worst qualities of these 10 people.
No. And make he's arguably, apart from David and Star, and David and Star are probably the two most like 100% accurate. Puma's like, maybe, let's say like 95-97% accurate.
Too much. He's awful. And
yeah.
There's so many of them. Like Officer Terry, I really fell for.
Yeah.
Because he was in a building with people that he was meant to be in charge of, and they were, one guy was just ruining his life. And there's all these, like, the thing I loved about the book is the intricacies. So it's an entire community. It's a society within those walls. They all have their roles. They all have things that they do. And I think people kind of have this mentality sometimes about prison where it's just people behind bars and that's it. But you have to create community and you have to create society. That's what they did. But Officer Terry, and Officer Bailey, I hated as well. I'm just telling you the people that I hated because you wrote them really, really
You did. Oh, good. Thanks.
I was like, I hate these people. But a few questions here. Sorry. Also, I just wanted to ask you the focus on the dreams. I know the books are called Dreams and Incarceration. That was one of the most interesting parts I found because it was a complete removal from what was happening within the book. So you would read these chapters of awful things happening, and then obviously the dreams were terrible, but you knew the dreams weren't real. And was there a reason you focused chapters on his dreams? Was that like what was the reason for that?
So the reasoning, the dream stuff, like, came about, I want to say, like, 3 weeks into me interviewing Dave. He started one day just talking about his own psychology and how, like, what kind of dreams or, like, nightmares he was having. And he basically, for lack of a better way, he basically said, the hardest time I did in prison was when my cell door closed at night and I was just lying in bed with my own thoughts. And then he told me, and then he relayed, like, a couple details about, like, his nightmares and stuff like that. Like, all of those dreams in the book and the nightmares, like, obviously those are, like, mostly, they're fiction. You know, I made the story and I just, like, did it that way, but David did, like, basically say, like, oh yeah, like, I was having this recurring dream where there was this, like, shadow chasing me and, like, this and that, whatever. So I did this because in prison, like, anywhere, I suppose, stoicism is huge. And with stoicism, like, you don't talk about your feelings or your emotions or anything like that. You keep everything bottled in, and when you do that, you know, you one day you're gonna, like, explode or you're gonna implode. A lot of characters explode. Like, you got, like, that guy Chains and stuff. Like, they're like people who are holding it in and they explode and they fight. Someone like David, I wanted to, another way to create sympathy was, you know, he keeps all of his emotions in. He didn't want to talk. He wanted to talk, but he couldn't talk to anyone else because talking is a sign of weakness. So his dreams are a visual representation for the reader about how he is feeling at that moment in time. They are also in some ways premonitions because, you know, you see, you know, with, like, David's mom and his brother and stuff, like, you see them, like, in kind of a weird way in the dream. And then, you know, in the next chapter, you find out they're dead and, like, stuff like that. And I wanted, yeah. And then as well as that, I wanted the dreams, like you said, to be a detachment from the prison because, like, it's heavy, man. Like, the prison stuff is so heavy. Like, even while I was writing it, I was like, I need a fucking break. Yeah, like, this is really tough. So even though the dreams and the nightmares are super intense, I wanted to take David out of prison. I wanted the reader to, like, see David, like, out of prison. But I also wanted to, like, still instill that, like, fear in David's brain. And then for his character, it's the stoicism. It's like, that is, like, the visual representation of his feelings and thoughts being bottled up.
Yeah. And I thought as well, just you touched on his mum and his brother there, which was incredibly sad. When I got to the part of that book, I was devastated because to lose both people that he was so, you know, attached to, and they were what was kind of keeping him going. The relationship part of the book I love because your book gave a feeling of everything's moving really fast, but it's also going very slow. And that's, it was like, oh, everything is happening, but also nothing is happening.
Yeah.
And I really, really like that. With regards to his mother and his brother, it was just that kind of feeling where they were continuing their lives outside. He was waiting to see them and then they died. So just horrific. Also, the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about was there was a part in the book where he met a girl.
Yep.
And they were in a relationship together. Did that part of the book, did you, when he talked about it, did you want to add that part into the book?
Yeah, I did, because I thought that was really sad. Like, so there's two sides to that coin. I think, like, you know, not to sound bad, but you have a prison with thousands of men and, like, none of them are, you know, going out with women or anything like that. Yeah. Like, they're going to say some pretty fucking awful things. And I know that that's mentioned in the book. And I know it's, for some people, it was like a little controversial. I've had some readers text me basically not saying some very nice things, but I thought it was important.
Was that because the last line he said to her on the phone?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And but it's just real. You know, it's like, yeah, that's his frustration. It's his frustration bubbled up to a point. You know, they were technically engaged and he still holds a lot of contempt. Yeah, they were engaged like in real life and he holds a lot of contempt because, you know, she lied to him and she technically cheated on him. But that being said, you know, like, let's be real here. Like, David was still serving like a life sentence. Like, if I was that girl, like, I wouldn't fucking wait. You know what I mean? Like, I think there are two sides to every story, but this book was from David's perspective and I would have done him a disservice if I didn't include it. Also, yeah. I wanted every chapter to have like little pockets of light. And for like three chapters or four chapters, like, she was his like little pocket of light. So that when it got stripped away, I wanted the reader to feel even worse for David. But in doing so, it sort of I wanted to give the sense of like that extra motivation to get over this and get out.
What was to me as well. I felt like because obviously unfortunately his brother and his mother were gone at that point, so it was like a beacon. And obviously when something terrible is going on in your life, you will cling to that one good thing that might get somewhere. That last line, I will say, that last line didn't piss me off. I wasn't upset at that last line. That last line was literally, I could feel every piece of vitriol he had about everything come out on that. It was like the final frustration for him. That's what it felt like to me. And I don't even think he meant it to hurt her. I think he was just hurt. And he was like, I don't know how else to express this. And he's the one person you attack when you really want to piss someone off, their mother. So, you know, but like, it didn't. Yeah. It just made me feel bad for everybody involved.
Yeah.
That sounds not true.
Text them back and tell them to leave me alone. You did a great job. did a great job.
Emma, that sentence not true, because me and you talk shit about each other's mothers all the time.
We're allowed to.
Okay, all right.
I was watching the video that you sent to me, and there was something David said that I really thought was... Whenever he speaks, I think to myself, I do nothing. I am a lazy sack. This man spent 15 years in prison and is doing more than I think I could ever possibly do. But he said, you asked him, how did you deal with, did you ever think what you did was acceptable? Like, how did you contend with that? And he said, I was selfish. I didn't love my mum and brother the way I thought I did. I didn't love myself the way I did. Everything I did was to make people like me. And to come to that word of realization as an adult is remarkable, because I don't think a lot of us will ever realize that. And he can say as an adult, everything I did was to make people like me, even murder, which I just thought was fucking, dude, that was such a heavy thing to hear. He seemed so aware of himself. And like, as his friend, you find that about him, like that he's hyper aware of himself.
100%. And that, I mean, he's a product of the California prison system for sure. He got out, but in order to get out, you have to become that self-aware. So there are classes and there are sort of programs that you have to do if you want to get parole. And the entire purpose of the programs is to, first of all, take accountability for what you've done and then show will and intention to improve. And that takes a really long time. You know, you have to like straight up convince like your victim's parents, you know, to get out, like things like that. But David, you know, he and I spoke about that particular piece like a lot. And he said that in these classes, if you don't have a good answer or like a real answer for anything, like you get called out in front of the entire class. Like, you're not allowed to like leave the class until you basically come up with, or basically until you're sort of self-realized in in whatever the topic is. So when it came to being a member of a gang, David was like, you know, I did it because it was like the easy way out. You know what I mean? Or like I was lazy. Like this was like the easy way out. Like I didn't want to work for my money, like things like that. And he just, yeah. So he's very, you know, he's extremely honest with himself. And even, you know, he and I have been in situations where we have just ran in, like we've been together, but we've talked with people who, you know, kind of, let's say they grew up like sheltered or anything like that. And David still like doesn't hold back. Like people have asked him like very blunt sort of ignorant questions in the past. And David keeps his cool. And he's like, yep, I did what I did. This is why I did it. But like, judge me if you want, but like, I'm going to probably be a better person.
The comfortability in who he is, I think. And that's for a normal person, but for a person that hasn't committed murder, that's difficult enough. But for him, I can't begin to imagine how difficult that must be. He's so strong. Like, he's remarkably strong. Just speaking about the gang affiliation there, one thing that I really noticed in the book is this idea of loyalty being toxic, because most people would find loyalty to be a really good trait, and you're loyal and you think about people and you care about people. But the loyalty in this book got to a point where I couldn't fathom how you have to give up yourself to be loyal to another person.
Yeah, the loyalty was, for me anyway, like a big anchor of the story. So the hardest thing that David had to do, like the reason why that, or like my reasoning for why the book would be like in a way like thrilling, is because he did have to walk a very fine line to get out. So you've got the institution on one side and you've got the gang on the other side. The institution doesn't protect you. The gang protects you. So David, being, you know, a pretty, like, you know, he was a well-respected member of his gang as a young man. Like, he had a name for himself. He was rough. Like, he would fight. Like, he held his own. And he basically, you know, he had to sort of let on that he was still 100% loyal to the gang, because if a fight breaks out in the yard, or if like someone in your gang gets like shanked by like someone in another gang, or basically anything, if your gang is like disrupted in any way by any other gang and on the loss, you have to have your gang members back. Like, you have to have your friends backs. If you don't, you then will get DP, like, disciplined. And then sometimes a discipline could straight up be murder. You know what I mean? It happens. And so David had to show the institution that he was willing and had the intent to like get out, but he also had to sort of like disassociate from his gang very carefully at the same time, while still remaining loyal, because that's how he felt. He's like, he still says it to this day. He's like, those guys were my brothers. I love them so much. Like, I'm always going to be their brother, but I just can't be doing any of this like dumb gang shit anymore. And that's, he describes it as dumb, because he's like, it's a young man's game. It's like, you know, why, he's like, why would you like ruin your life for this? You know what I mean? The loyalty is like, it's huge, and it's a very human thing for him. And he loves his friends, and because to him, they are his friends. But he's also, he came to the realization pretty quickly that his loyalty was toxic, and it was going to keep him in prison for the rest of his life. So he did have to walk that very fine line to appease both sides.
Yeah. And like, even in the book, those parts of the book where something is going to happen, and you can hear him trying to be like, how do I navigate this? And then when people were going to get into fights, him like grabbing people to the ground or stopping his friends and doing it in a way that didn't come across as them going, you're only doing this because you want to get out.
Yeah. He's very smart.
Incredibly smart.
Like, is it like, when I watched him in that interview, there's just this like balance that it's like, you can see how incredibly smart he is, but also how much of an effective communicator is, but also how incredibly disciplined. And it's a shame, because if he had opportunity when he was younger, he's so incredibly gifted that if he had the opportunity that others have, this it, like that, this wouldn't have been his life. But also the loyalty piece that's really interesting to me is he doesn't make the people around him that have made these terrible, shitty decisions like him feel like shit. He somehow is like, manages to like empathize with them and remain like a confidant for them and someone they rely on, but also is like, also like somehow makes them realize like what you're doing is really silly. Like, do you get that? But not in a way where it's like undermining them or being like, you're a moron, you're an idiot. It's, he's such a dynamic individual. In that interview, I was like, this guy is so dynamic. He's so well balanced. I can understand why you met him at a party and was like, I'm going to hang out with this guy.
Yeah.
It's that thing of like when you hear a story, and then when you hear how clever he was about being like, I've got to play this system. I've got to keep myself safe in with this, with the gang that I'm a member of, but I've also got to figure out a way to work on me and continue to work on me to get out of the system. It was so, it like that, it was just really clever and really smart and really effective.
It's probably one of my favorite parts of the book, was just being like, what's he gonna do, like kind of trying to figure out, because I wouldn't have a clue what to do.
But you'd, this man, Emma,
yeah, I would be shit. I would be dead in 3 seconds. I would be the worst person in prison. But it was almost like the way he acted in his gang was got him through prison in a weird fucked up way. Like, it was, he was able to navigate it because of that, which is deeply sad, but also a very stark reality. And I know Sarah's from Ballyhale, you're from Finglas, and I'm from a fucking stupid little village in the country. But, you know, I don't think this story is a million miles away from what you guys probably have experienced growing up and what I see in Ballyfermot still, like the idea of indoctrinating children at a young age into crime, and then they go to prison, and then they're really messed up in prison, and then they get out and they do it again. But for David, fortunately, he was able to turn that around. But he is a success story, and there are plenty of people, unfortunately, that like aren't success stories. But this is going on in LA, and to be able to kind of go, I understand this from Ballyhale, you know?
That bit definitely resonated with me, that idea of like being in, like, and I think that bit of empathizing as well, like I've grown up in social housing, I'm from Ballyferma, like I have relatives who have been involved in criminality and gangland activity and all of that stuff, and it's, I would say when I was younger, I don't think it's to the same extreme level of like gangland criminality in the States. We are definitely at a point in Ireland where it has gotten to that similar level. We have gun violence, we have higher crime rates in terms of like men shooting each other, males killing each other. But I grew up in Ballyferm, I have a younger brother, and it was easier for my brother to get by in Ballyferm by being friends with these individuals than it was way more difficult if he wasn't friends. He was going to have a really difficult time. He was going to walk up the road and be picked on. He was going to be beaten up. All of that. He's going to be ostracized by what you consider your peer group at that age. For a girl, it's different. I didn't have that same issue. But yeah, like growing up where I'm from, I definitely get that sense from him where it's like, you don't really have any other options. But also that idea of like doing things to make people like you, that happens in every part of society. He just happened to live in a part of society where it's like, to get by, we sell drugs.
Yeah.
We rob shit. Like, that's how we get by. And so therefore, if you like, you want to be liked by your peer group, you're doing that too. And that is a story that happens, unfortunately, in every area of society. It just happens different. Like, do you know what I mean? In Dundrum and Ballsbridge, it's like, buy those stupid shoes and wear this. Like, it's like, your dad's a solicitor. Oh my God. My mom's a, it's just a different peer pressure, plain and simple. And also when you're a kid, when you're young, like him, the front part of your brain hasn't developed. You don't have a sense of like, this has long-term repercussions for the rest of my life. It's like, this is what I do now, and this gets me by.
And I should have put this, in retrospect, I think it would have added to the book, but I also don't know exactly how I would have done it. But David, how he joined his gang was, I think he was like 12-ish, and he was, he was like boxing at his local like YMCA. here and in his like neighborhood, and his neighborhood like had, he moved around south central LA like a lot, and a bunch of different neighborhoods with like single mom and all that sort of stuff. But he basically was leaving his gym one day, and there were a bunch of these like gangbangers that basically just started like a fight with him. And they were like, you know, next time we see you, like we're gonna kill you, like all this sort of stuff. So David, the next time he goes back to the gym, he, you know, does his training, and he comes out and he sees the same guys there. And one of the guys goes to his car to get a gun. So David ran to the local police station, and the sheriff wouldn't help him. The sheriff basically told him to fuck off. And so David, without not knowing what to do, went to a gangster's house that lived on a street trying to buy a gun. He might have been like 13, but very, very young, trying to buy a gun. He's like, I need to protect myself, otherwise these guys are going to kill me. And the gangster like laughed in his face. He's like, you know what? Like, I like you, little man. Like, you know, you're one of us now. He's like, we're not going to give you a gun, but like, we'll protect you. And yeah, so
and that's,
you know,
how easily it happened, how quickly he was.
I'm definitely paraphrasing his story, but I've heard it so many times that those are like sort of the major details. And, you know, there's obviously, you know, because as humans, like, we don't remember everything perfectly. I'm sure there's like a few little details here and there that are different, but the sort of, you know, the message is that David did not plan to be a gang member. He was like, he was sort of like, because it was this big in the 90s and like early 2000s, there's big allure with gangs in LA and specifically in all over the US, because you had guys like Snoop Dogg and Tupac and Biggie, like all these really cool rappers like making millions and millions and millions, and like being surrounded by like all these hot chicks, and like, you know, you're like a 12-year-old poor ass kid from South Central LA, like you want that, you know. But David had a very smart, loving mother who did her best, and David, you know, he didn't necessarily want that, but he felt that he had to because he was in danger.
It's really sad because he went and did the what we would consider the right thing first. He went to the authorities and was like, I need help. And then it was like, well, we can't help you. And then they just pushed him right into the arms of like these gang members. It's really funny that you mentioned like the 90s and early 2000s, because when Emma was talking about this book, I did make a joke about like my only real understanding of gangs is like Ricky Lake in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Have the people that'd be like, come on. And then they'd bring those kids to like prison and be like, do you want to end up like this? And it was really aggressive and like, and I watch old, I watch old clips of them with the kids that are like, I don't give a fuck.
I actually wanted to ask you about David's auntie Cheryl. Is that the name?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say she isn't actually his auntie. It's just like, it's kind of like an African American thing that you're like, she's my auntie. Like, you're my uncle. Yeah. It's like just like an older person who is like a positive influence on them. So she was like an older woman, much older woman, positive influence on him as a child that everybody, all the like families in the neighborhood just sort of like trusted. And she was like Mama Goose to like all these like little kids.
And the opening chapter of the book where they're doing the little trial, I was like, I'm just going to enjoy this because I know the terrible thing. But it is honestly, for a book about incarceration and the horrors of incarceration, it's like a moment where it's like, okay, this is actually very sweet and very nice, and she can see potential in him and she wants him to do well, and then it just all goes to pot. But no, she was wonderful. I really, really enjoyed her character. You gave people a really believable voice, I think is what I enjoyed. Because I've read books where, because you're Irish, obviously, so, you know, you read books sometimes where people who aren't from the country write the book, and it's, you're like, oh, you're obviously from Finglas, but you're in your book, it wasn't like that at all. It was very much believable how they spoke and everything about them. So I really, really enjoyed that. I just have a few more questions. I have one here that it says, do you feel like your friendship with him has changed you in any way? Do you feel like you've learned anything from David? Do you think you look at things a little bit differently now? Or
Yeah, big time. I'm a little bit more of like a realistic person nowadays. I think who I was before this, I was like a little bit more immature. I've matured a lot, and the reason I think that is because I have been like over the last year, I've spent so much time talking with people who younger Killian would have thought was like, pardon my French, like a fucking piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like I would have thought all of these people were awful people. I never would have spoken to them. And now I just kind of, I don't know. I just kind of realize that not everything is like black and white. And I know that's such a cliche thing to say, but like not everything is black and white. And like, it's easy to like just slip down that slope. You know, I'm not saying any one of us three is going to be, you know, hopping into a Chevy and doing a drive-by, but
I might.
She might.
Well, Sarah might. It depends. Yeah, if your husband keeps acting up, maybe. I developed a lot of sympathy for people like David and for people who sort of like are incarcerated and all that sort of stuff. But on the other hand, I'm extremely like way more of a realistic person now. Like I do not like if someone is just like giving me shite, or if they're like kind of like, if they're not being like direct with me, or they're kind of lying, or they're like fumbling with their words and like things like that. Like I'm way more direct, and I'm like, okay, just tell me the fucking truth. Like what's up? Cause I'm so used, like I've spent so much time talking with people who are just so direct with me about like these really hard things to like mentally come to terms with, like murder. And they're just so direct with me that I think now I'm just like a little bit less patient with people that are like spoofing and things like that. Yeah. Which is overall, it's a pretty innocent, like adjustment to my character, but it's something that I've noticed like every day. It's like, I just have way less time for spoofers and things like that, you know?
I think that's a really positive thing. And obviously you've spoken to people who have spent a lot of their life not having time and being like, I need to do this now because I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So, you know, their reactions to things would obviously be different than us who are just like, la, 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 everything's grand. Do you think he's learned anything from you? Has he told you that he's learned anything from you?
He hasn't told me that he's learned anything. And I don't want to put any words in his mouth, but I will say that, like, I'm not tooting my own horn by any means, but I would say that there's a little bit more warmth in his life than there was previously. I'm a very like caring individual when it comes to this kind of thing. Like, I've written a few other books, and I do them like I write books about people. I do these heavy, heavy research interviewing processes, and it's really important to me that they feel like comfortable and like genuinely cared for. In tandem with that, like my mom, not that I'm like little mommy's boy writing, but like my mom like loves the fact that I write books, and she reads all of them, and she's just so interested. And like, she's been out in LA, and the three of us, my mom, David, and myself, have gone to meet up for coffee. My mom, when David posts on Instagram, my mom sends him like love hearts, like so proud of you, like all this stuff. So there's a little bit more warmth in his life now than there was previously, which I know that he really appreciates. But like I said, like he's still quite a stoic figure. We don't talk about our feelings that much unless it's in the context of like the book and like writing and that kind of thing.
And can I ask, you spoke about your previous books. I'm so sorry, I don't really know it. Could you tell me what your previous books are?
Yeah, so the book that I wrote right before Dreams and Incarceration was called Death by a Million Paper Cuts. I interviewed a woman who was married to a headmaster of a very prestigious boarding school for like 30 years in New England and on the East Coast of the US. One day the FBI came knocking on her door, and they told her that her husband, who was the headmaster of like a really prestigious boarding school, was being accused of sexually assaulting his students. And the FBI wanted her to work with them against her husband without him knowing. So she kind of had to become like a spy within her own home to like help take down her husband, but she didn't fully believe like all the accusations. And in order to write that book, I did a lot of hand holding for that. She was going through, like, still is going through a really hard time. That was years ago, but she's got severe PTSD because of it. I spoke with like a bunch of sexual assault victims to write that book. And like, that was really heavy. That was right before Dreams. And then there's the one that I'm working on now. I can't talk about it too much, but like, it's really fucking nuts. I'm going back there next week, but I lived in Panama, in Central America for like a month and a half, writing about this. Essentially, they had a dictator in the 1980s, and I'm doing like the same kind of thing that I did with David, with this guy who was involved in the regime. And then I have started to do the research. I'm doing my next book after that is going to be an Irish one. Actually, it's about a guy called Nicky Kelly, who was falsely imprisoned for being a member of the IRA in the 1980s, kind of like a In the Name of the Father type story. But Nicky's still alive and he lives in Dublin, and it's a really, really awesome story. And so, yeah.
Nothing, no fluff pieces then. No happy joy.
Yeah, well, like I'm always, well, and then I'm doing, like, for my happiness, I do a little fiction as well. So I'm
okay, cool.
Out here in LA, I wrote a movie, or like, I'm a member of like a couple of screenwriters that wrote this movie that hopefully will be picked up soon. And it's a little animated PG comedy that's like good fun and all this stuff. So I try not to be too dark.
Or like, your IMDb is like all of the like sexual abuse. Children's movie.
It's crazy. Yeah.
No, but that's amazing. I'm definitely going to pick up Death by a Million Paperclips 100%. But yeah, are you working on anything else with David, or are you kind of finished?
No, we're not really working on anything. Ideally, what I'd love to there. So David wants to ultimately be a motivational speaker. I'm doing what I can to help him. So I'm doing a lot of, like, I've gained sort of a little bit of credibility in the prison education space here in the US, specifically in California. So I've been in touch with like, I think 18 different, like 20 different colleges in the US. And David actually just gave a lecture at a criminal justice for a criminal justice class last week in San Francisco. And so we're still doing stuff together, and it's mostly to service his growth as a motivational speaker. And then we're trying to set up a TED talk in April, because there's a college about an hour away from LA called Cal State Fullerton. And they have this like prison education fair. It's like a week long thing every spring. And the guy who runs it has given a couple of TED talks himself, and he really loves what David and I are doing. So us three are going to try get one set up for David, but like, it's kind of a lot of work. And, you know, I'm doing like that Panama thing and doing like the IRA adjacent story. So it's difficult. I don't know if it will happen, but it's the plan to get that going. For
the video you sent me, you mentioned a documentary with David. So that's
like always sort of in the cards. There's a production company that wants to do a documentary about David. There's no money behind it, which is like obviously the most important thing. So if there's money behind it, we'll totally do it. I have pretty good standing with a couple prisons here that we can actually go into, and like David can give like a talk in front of all the inmates and stuff. But as well as that, there's, you know, ideally I'd love to make it like a feature film, like a narrative film. So I am sort of always on the lookout for people who are interested in prison stories, because it's really niche. But weirdly enough, in Hollywood, there's like this sort of silo of the industry where people are really tied in with like the prison stuff in California for whatever reason, and I have no idea why, but like there's a lot of support. Like, I think it probably is because a lot of celebrities have gone to prison, you know what I mean, like they have spent time in these prisons. So like David has this really cool story, just very quickly, but he was in LA County jail in the mid-2000s at the same time that Robert Downey Jr. was at the LA County jail. And David says Robert Downey Jr. made whatever the governing body of that jail was, like, kind of kick into gear and make things better for the inmates. So David was like, before RDJ, like, they didn't have like water flasks that they could carry around and shit like that. It's like, because there were so many cameras on Downey Jr. they kind of made things better. Like, and that's just like one little example that David sort of was there to witness. But yeah.
Using your power for good, which is a very rare thing that happens. But yeah, because when I'm reading the book, I know Netflix do a lot currently, a lot of like serial shows where they do like, you know, half hour segments. And so, and I was just thinking David would be perfect for one of those. Like, yeah, absolutely perfect for it. So I do hope you guys get to do something else, because I mean, your camaraderie alone and how you are with each other, and the fact the way you wrote that book was, it seemed so personal that I would definitely love to see like something else come of it. But
yeah, you're actually really good at building trust with people.
Yeah.
I don't
think
I'd let anybody inside my head and hear all the stupid shit I've done.
Yeah, it's sad. It's like, I do have like a little bit of a knack for that. But I think it's I think it's just because I'm coming at it from a very genuine perspective. And then also I've lost money on this book. Just like, I haven't made like a fucking cent. I've definitely lost like $500+ just sending free copies out to people. But you know, we split everything 50-50. Like, that is our agreement. Like, it's written down. It's like, whatever I make, you make. Like, you're letting me write your story. Like, I don't want to come across, because like, I very much, and I'm sure I still do with some people in David's world, but I definitely came across as like the greedy white man in the beginning. You know what I mean? It's like, David told me, he's like, he had some of his friends and they're like, what you doing trusting that white boy? Like, he's just gonna, you know, he's gonna screw you. But he and I, we've always just been very upfront with each other. And I'm like, listen, whatever I make, you make. Like, this is 50-50. I don't want this. I don't want there to be any contention between us. Like, I didn't do this like for the money. I did this so that I could prove I could do something so big and so heavy that like in the future I could, you know, write other stuff that will make me money. So, I would say we have full trust for each other, but that's like the most important thing writing the book, is that like the person just like trusts you and they don't think you're trying to screw them or like shit or like, yeah, make them look bad or anything like that.
Well, you did a phenomenal job, dude. The book is great. It's so poignant. Killian, thank you so much for talking to us, and thank you for sending us the book. And I'm going to go buy your other books. Is there anywhere specific you prefer people to buy them, or?
No, they're only on Amazon. They're only on Amazon. And I think I might have sent you the PDF for Death by a Million Paperclips.
You did? Emails. I'm gonna start tonight.
yeah. So you no need to buy it.
Don't be a cheap old bitch. Go buy the book.
I'll get the buyer.
No. You're all right. You already have it.
But yeah, just to say thank you so, so much for talking to us. And I really hope a lot of people after listening to this podcast go out and buy the book, because it helps David and it helps Killian. And it's always good to be aware of incarceration in America, because it's unfortunately a very, very frightening thing, and obviously a very racially biased thing as well. So if you can support David and Killian, that would be amazing. Have you any final words, Sarah Jean?
No, just thank you so much for wanting to come on to our ridiculous podcast.
Okay.
We really appreciate it. And I hope that you do really well. I have to say, like, I'm going to sound like such an old, like, crudder, but like, you're, for your age and everything you've achieved, genuinely, like, fair play to you. Like, you clearly have an awful lot of like commitment and belief in yourself. And that's something that 28-year-olds and 29-year-olds generally struggle with. So like, really well done. Fair play. And I really hope things go well. And I hope that it goes really well for David. I just think the story is really inspiring. And I think you've done a phenomenal job gaining his trust, building a friendship, and then putting his story into words.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for having me on the podcast as well. I do really appreciate it. I can't wait to listen back to it, and have my mom is going to be the first person to listen to it.
What's her name?
Gabrielle.
Gabrielle. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi, Gabrielle.
Great name. Gabrielle. Oh, my God. Fantastic. Yeah. But good luck in Panama with everything. And maybe when that's out, I'd love maybe for you to come back on and we could talk about that, if that's okay.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, I've no idea when that will come out. But I am I am back in Dublin for the whole month of December doing that interview with Nikki. So maybe if I have enough by then, I'd love to talk about that as well. And just because that would be done really, really fast, I would say so.
Perfect. Okay.
You know, our following are deeply, deeply into like anything to do with Nikki Kelly. So definitely in terms of like that story, we would have a lot of people that would like be interested and keen to hear that. We have a massive amount of like Irish people living abroad that listen to us, and they're really into that. Definitely if you can come back on.
Well, I'll be in touch anyways, and I'll be supporting and listening. But until I see you next, thank you again. And
no problem.
And all the best.
Talk to you soon.
Have a good day.
All right.
Bye.
All right. Bye, guys.
She said it's just a phase. Fermented with our father's gaze, I caught the bride's bouquet. Now I'm waiting in the chapel for a fresh coat of paint, they say. No, I'm not trying to be that bitch. I'm just up here trying to make a difference. Drinking for the nerve, but I'm all fucked up. And I'm worried about my hair and my makeup. I made me matter for a minute. For about an hour I was all up in it. Now I'm locked down, shivering the secondhand shade. And I hate on every choice that I ever made, ever made. This life just isn't to my taste, so I beat my face. Try to tell myself it's just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream, it's only a dream. It's just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream. Yo, it's only a dream.
Yo, this could be a super villain origin story, cause not too long ago I was just a regular girlie, too preoccupied with boys and spending all of my money on some see-through material just to cover my body.
That's
then
right.
Then one night I had an accident that set me apart. I was exposed to an element and it captured my heart. Yeah, those ill-begotten daughters of the glamorous game. Yeah, they gave me a home and let me pick my new name. So I took to the stage just like a knife to an artery, and I gave you my spirit and made this killer a part of me. I'm no longer a character, I'm a fucking calamity. I'm serving you make-believe with the side of reality. But I took it too far and let the parasites get to me. Slamming shots at the bar, I'm living off cocaine and ecstasy. And I murder my friends, set up camp with my enemies. Till the day I decided to keep the monster inside of me.
But I can't leave it in its place, so I beat my face.
Tell myself it's just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream, it's only a dream.
Why rest my case?
Tell myself it's just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream, it's only a dream.
And I'll be mine. This one's for my mother, sister, and how I'm sorry I let you down.
Just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream, it's only a dream.
My dream.
Trying to tell myself it's just a dream, but I can't unsee what I've seen, what I've seen. I'm a killer, I'm a villain, I'm a fiend, but it's only a dream.
Thank you.
Every year, thousands of people go to their very first concert. Our boosted signal at large events means they can always call a taxi to get home.
Mom? Yeah. It was grand. Do you think you could pick me up?
Every connection counts, which is why Ireland can count on our network. Vodafone. Together we can.
Subject to coverage availability. Limitations and terms apply. See vodafone.ie/terms.